Hi, I'm Rachel. I'm an alcoholic. And I live south of Charlottesville in Red Hill, Virginia. But my meetings are all in Charlottesville. And I got sober on September 21st, 1988. And by the grace of God, I've been able to not take a drink since that time. I get a little nervous doing this. I also, you know, it's like I, going back to what it was like, is sometimes not my favorite thing to do, but I also realize that our stories are the greatest gift that we can give to others. So I'm going to go back. I was talking, three lovely ladies rode up here with me, and we were talking on the way, and it was kind of like a pre-story, and but I was born in Ontario, Canada. And, you know, I had an interesting upbringing. I didn't really realize it at the time, but I think if you're looking from the outside, you know, it's sort of different. My dad was a minister. I've got four siblings. It was a teetotaler family. I was raised with the notion that drinking was a sin. Coffee, but we didn't drink coffee in our family. We didn't dance. We didn't really do anything fun. But having said that, I had fun growing up. Living in Canada, we're very close to nature up there, and we did a lot of things, and camping and fishing and hunting and those types of things. So I had that sensibility. When I was 14 years old, my family moved to New Jersey for my dad's job. He's a big deal in my church. He became administrator of the North Atlantic States region. And our home was in New Jersey. And that was a big shock to me. I didn't enjoy living in New Jersey. I did enjoy the summers when we would go to the different church camps up and down the East Coast. So we went to camps and Maine and Cape Cod and Bucks County, Pennsylvania. So those are pretty nice areas. I remember going to Virginia Beach for the first time. So that was good. And I actually met my husband at one of those church camps when I was 15 years old. He was 18. We didn't immediately get together, and we've been through a lot together. But we did meet at that age. At 19, I went off to the church college. At 17, I went off to the church college. And that is interestingly where I took my first drink. So my parents really tried to give us this very protected upbringing. But the alcoholism comes through. And what I understand today, because when I was 2 years sober and I finally screwed up my courage to tell my mother that I was an alcoholic, she said, "I think my father was an alcoholic." And I really feel like her life was a response to his alcoholism. So she tried to create a world without alcohol. And it did pretty good. Still does, actually. She has a very abnormal relationship to alcohol and doesn't believe that anybody can drink socially. It's all or nothing. Her father, she would find him drunk on the sidewalk in front of their house, coming home from a date. So I think that's pretty good evidence. Her brother died of this disease. He was in his 70s, but he had a health issue, and when they were going to do some surgery, actually did some surgery, and they saw how much damage was done to his liver, they said, "We can't do this." And he died after that. So I'm the only one, however, of my siblings who seems to have this problem. So I've always been like the black sheep of the family, the different one, the one my mother says tested her. And I don't think I was ever comfortable in my skin, even from a young age. I was thinking today about this trip. I must have been 9 or 10 years old, and I was always trying to do something with the older kids. I was never comfortable where I was. I just wanted to be with the older kids because they were cooler. And I convinced my sisters to take me on this bike ride that they were going on. I just begged and begged and begged. And so they finally let me come because they couldn't stand me. I was so annoying. And then we get out on there, and we're out on this country road, and I got tired of riding. And so I just stopped riding, and I lay down on the ground, and I had a temper tantrum. I just told them I wasn't going to ride anymore. I mean, I don't know what they're going to do, you know. I couldn't go one more foot, you know. And so I was a little bit of a drama queen. So that first drink, anyway, back to college, back to the first drink, because I really love my sobriety, and I actually like to talk about my sobriety more, but we'll see how I do here. So I took that first drink, and it was a Boone's Farm apple wine, and it was pretty wonderful, actually. I was extremely shy. You know, I was like a legend in my own mind, but I didn't talk a whole lot. I re-met a cousin that I hadn't seen in several years, a couple of years ago. He said, "Oh, yeah, you're the shy one." You're the shy one. So I took that first drink, and it allowed me to talk. And I just had a real rosy glow about the whole evening. And I was able to flirt with the guy that I was really interested in, and it was just, you know. But what I didn't know about myself is that I was an alcoholic. I thought I'd really thrown off the shackles of my family upbringing to recognize that I could drink socially. I took that first drink in January of 1973, and. By August, I really basically just went on a binge, is what it was. I drank whenever I could, as much as I could afford. If I get people to buy me drinks, I would, you know, drink as long as I could. Till I passed out, blacked out, threw up. You know, we all know the story. But by August of that year, I had tried to kill myself twice, and I was pregnant by a married man who was actually one of my girlfriend's husbands, and he was 26 and I was 18. I tried to kill myself at that point. I was really, really ready for a program. But in Iowa in 1973, I went to the local doctor there in this little town where the college was. And I told him, I never even saw him. The man I was with when I tried to kill myself, I was drinking beer and I just started taking all these aspirin. And he made me throw up. And I'm grateful for that because, you know, you can kill yourself by ODing on aspirin. And it was the only thing I could find, which drove me crazy because I was hanging out with those people. I was doing drugs too, you know, and I just thought I could just get something and just overdose. And I couldn't find anything. So the only thing I could find were these aspirin. And he made me throw up, and he called the local doctor, and the doctor said, "Just tell her she's crazy." That was very helpful. And the next morning, and then he left, and he said, "Can I do anything for her?" I said, "Love some orange juice." And he just never came back. And the next morning, I was just shaking, and my sister lived in that town, and I walked over to her house, and she took me. By this point, my parents had moved to Kansas City, and my sister drove me down to my parents, and I just remember wailing and crying and wailing and just begging for some help, and they didn't believe in psychiatry or counseling or anything like that, and I knew at that moment I was on my own. And it was actually kind of it was like my first bottom, and it was pretty pivotal, and I thought, well, it's up to me. You know, I have to do this thing on my own. So this is when I started to control my drinking. And I thought, you know, if I just paid for it myself, if I wasn't dependent on men, a lot of times I was dependent on men to buy drinks for me. And I would, you know, and I dropped out of school. We sort of had this reciprocal agreement, the school and I. They sort of asked me to leave because I wasn't going to classes. I used to study for exams by taking LSD, and, you know, it just didn't work very well. So I left school. I moved into my parents in the Kansas City area, and I worked at A&W Root Beer's Car Hop. And I was buying my own drugs and alcohol, which gave me an element of self-esteem. But I did some crazy things even during that time. I mean, I can just remember, I'm not a huge blackout drinker, but I would do the brownout thing and just, like, wake up and, like, what am I doing here? And, you know, just, and I, the first time I drank liquor, I did go into a blackout. So my solution to that is I became a beer and wine drinker, except when there wasn't any beer or wine, and then I would go into the liquor. But I just blacked out too quickly, and I didn't want that to happen. So, you know, I'd be in the wrong parts of Kansas City by myself, you know, 18 years old. I just sort of was horrified at some of the things I did. I don't know. You know, it's the grace of God, I think, that I'm here today. I know that. My husband and I, at this time, he graduated from college, and he moved to Kansas City to be close to me. And we like to say we've been going steady since 1974. and then he couldn't find work there, and I was, you know, we've just been together ever since. And he's from Maryland, so we moved to Maryland, and we just both got jobs, and my disease progressed. And I'm very grateful to that I married the particular man that I did marry, because I think he saved my life. You know, you can say enable, but on the other hand, he enabled me not to die. So we lived together for 3 years before we were married, and I cheated on him with this coke dealer. And I really wanted to, I thought maybe the coke dealer was a good choice. You know? But then he started shooting drugs, and I just couldn't quite, that scared me. It really scared me. And I thought I only had two choices, was to stay with my husband or go with this guy, and I decided to stay with my husband because he was stable. He seemed like a stable person, and he is. And I just kind of, I could see my future, you know. It's like, coke dealer, die. Stay with this husband, live. Stay with this man. So that's how we got married. And I, the thing is, I never thought I had the choice of, like, just going out on my own, like having an independent life, because I wasn't raised that way. I was just raised to find the right man, and you know, there wasn't really much encouragement to be independent. And because he also grew up in the same church that I grew up in, we have that basic understanding, although we've not ever really been active members, but we know what we both grew up with. And the fact that most of my family is still all very active, and his family in their religion. So, you know, we have, you know, it's been a good thing for us to have that basic foundation. So anyway, got married, had my first kid, managed to stay sober throughout the pregnancy. But as soon as that baby was born, as soon as my mother left, she came and stayed for 2 weeks. I was upstairs at a neighbor's apartment with the beer and the bong, you know. And there were times when I was too drunk to take care of my baby. And like I say, my husband took care of the baby. I wouldn't hear the baby cry. He would get up with the baby. We moved to Charlottesville in 1979, January 1st, 1979, and it was a Geographic. You know, it was going to be a new start, and I wasn't going to smoke pot anymore. I wasn't going to drink anymore because I was a daily pot user at that point. And I was going to get involved in some things that were good for me. And I was a stay-at-home mom. And so I took a yoga class, and I actually started going to the spiritual group thing. And the yoga class, I met a woman my age with a baby, same age as my son. And she said, "Do you want to have lunch after?" And I lived right across the road, and I said, "Well, let's go to my apartment, and we'll have some lunch." I walked in, and we got inside. She said, "Do you smoke pot?" And I just, like, cried. I just had this sinking feeling, you know. It's just like, is it on my forehead, you know? And, of course, like, when you look around, you know who the stoners are. I mean, it's pretty easy to tell. And I couldn't say no, you know. I couldn't say no. I got involved in this spiritual group. And one of the tenets they had is that you couldn't use any psychedelic drugs at all, and they included marijuana in that. So I actually did. In June of that year, I was initiated in this group, and I stopped using drugs, and I'm very, very grateful. Because I was never happy with my drug use. I have to tell you, I was never happy with my drug use. I was always not wanting to do it. And I thought that drinking was okay, because it was legal. And, yeah. And this group, I had a very small group in Charlottesville, and most of them did not drink. So I thought that was kind of part of it, because that's what religion meant to me. It was not drinking. And so I had a couple of years where I didn't drink. And I got pregnant again, and my second son was born. And, I mean, it was just a really nice period for me. I was really conscious, working on a spiritual program. Consciously wanted this child, and you know, it was just a really special time. However, after he was born, I got a little depressed, and my spiritual teacher said, "I think that you need to get out more, and that you and your husband should go out and have a glass of wine." She didn't know who I was, you know. And I again had that sinking feeling, and it really felt like that, you know, the angel on one shoulder and the devil on the other, and the angel saying, "You know, she doesn't know who you are," and the devil say, "All right, permission." And we went out and had a glass of wine, and the way I drink is that I don't know how to stop. And I had a glass of wine, I had another glass of wine, and as we drove home, you know, my husband's having to stop the car so I can throw up several times. That's what happens when I drink. And so that just started off again for me. I started to work outside the home. I started working for post office for 40-plus hours a week. When you're new, they always work you real hard. And to make, you know, kind of see if you've got the stuff to do it. Until you become a regular employee. So I had three young kids at home. I mean, I had two. Oh, wait a minute. I forgot I had another kid. Wait, I got to back up. So I was drinking, and then my third son was conceived on a binge, and I didn't want to be pregnant again. I just wasn't ready for another child. And I did. I didn't drink during the pregnancy, and you know. And he was born, and you know, it was fine. It was fine, and he's great. he was a really sweet baby. He was the only baby I had that was he slept a lot. He was a quiet baby. My first son had colic, and I always thought people lied when they had these babies that were like quote good babies, but he was a really easy baby. So that was good. And then when he was 17 months, that's when I went to work full time. And I actually had a pretty good thing going. I had started a preschool in my home. And I actually went to an art show for one of my students. I was like her first teacher, and she's like 28 now, and she's an artist. And Eliza Evans, so she had an opening, her first real art gallery opening on Friday night, and I went to that. So I do have a regret that I gave up that preschool, but I went for the materials, for the money, the post office. I couldn't beat that. I worked 6 in the evening till 2:30 in the morning, or like 3 in the afternoon until 2:30 in the morning, and I found out the places where you can drink in Charlottesville at 2:30 in the morning, like the Outs Club and the veterans, Foreign War, VFW, yep, guys will be there playing cards, and I'd be like the only woman. And it was, you know, more nights out of the week than not, I would go find where I could drink. And I would be praying that my husband would be asleep when I got home so that we wouldn't have to have the argument. And I would just like try to inch into bed so that he wouldn't know that I've been drinking. And so then he would go off to work in the morning, and I'd be up with the kids. I don't know how I did this. At the end, I wasn't eating. In May of 88, I have to say I wasn't eating well. I was drinking more than I was eating. I was down to 117 pounds. Which right now, I weigh 135 pounds, and I am not a big woman. So I was a stick. I was a stick. I was sleeping maybe 4 hours a night. And I got pneumonia in May. And the doctor, and I refused. I didn't believe in doctors. I thought they were all charlatans. All they wanted was your money. And I didn't believe in medical, you know, all my children were born at home, and because I was frankly afraid to go to the hospital, because I was afraid of I was so non-assertive, I was just afraid of things being done to me that I didn't want done, and I wouldn't be able to tell somebody, no, you know, I don't want that done to me. So, so all my kids were born at home. So I lost the feeling in my legs one evening, and that's when I went to the hospital. I thought, well, this is serious. And they diagnosed me with pneumonia, and the doctor wanted to admit me, and I refused. And he said, if you promise me that you will go home, and you will stay in bed, and I mean in bed for a month, and you take these antibiotics, as if he had any power, but you know, he said, you know, if you will do that for me, you know, you just go home and do that. And I did, but I called my mother, who lived in Missouri, and I said, you know, or somewhere. Actually, I don't think she was in Missouri then. They moved a lot, Michigan or Ohio or somewhere. And I asked her if she would come and, you know, be with the children with me, and she just laughed. I used up whatever I had with my family. She said, I can't do that. My mother-in-law did come down. She lived in Maryland, so she came down and helped when she could, and I stayed in bed. And then I was off work for a month, and then I started back half-time. Oh, and during this time, I was journaling. I am a writer, and I've always written, but I was journaling, and a couple of years into sobriety, I pulled out that journal, and I looked at it during that month, and it said, when I am better, I will get my drinking under control. And I can't remember thinking that I had a drinking problem at that point. So I worked half-time for a couple of weeks, and then I started back full-time. But, you know, and I was a smoker, too. So, and then I was so I'm working full time, and I felt well enough to have a beer. That's what it was. I felt good enough to have a beer. And by August of that year, I was drinking just as much as I had been before and more. And I had my last drunk. I did things that I was terribly embarrassed about. Oh, by the way, during this time period too, I'm also having an affair with a coworker. And my husband and I worked in the same place. So, this is who I was. This is what I did. And, you know, my husband swears he didn't know that that was going on, but a lot of people knew it was going on. And people respected him and just kept their mouths shut. So I don't think they respected me very much. So my last drunk, I was... my sobriety date is in September because... Well, my last drunk, however, was in August, early August. And I convinced Dan that I needed to go out dancing. And I went with a coworker, not the one I had broken up the affair. And but I did go out with his roommate to go dancing. And I was a designated driver, and I wasn't going to drink. And it was the day before we were going on vacation. And I wasn't going to drink. So because I wasn't going to drink, when I went to pick up this guy who had a restricted license, which is why I had to pick him up, and of course my husband's at home babysitting, he offered me some pot, and I thought, well, I'm not going to drink, so I can smoke a little pot. And I have to say, people say it doesn't impair your driving, but I did drive up over a curb, so I don't know. And then we got there and parked, and I had an orange juice, and I had a glass of water, and I danced some. You know, I think I had a couple glasses of water. And then I told myself that thing that we all tell ourselves, or at least I don't know about you, but I do. What harm will one drink do? And I had the beer. And then I was going back to his place, and then I started drinking wine. I drank up all the wine in the apartment, and then I started drinking vodka. So my last drink was a screwdriver, which I hate. It was like this much vodka and this much orange juice. And then I couldn't go home, and he's calling my husband, and they're having, like, his roommate, my ex-boyfriend, lover, whatever, is there, and they're having this fight, argument. I don't really know what's going on. I just know I can't move. And they call my husband, tell him I can't get home. And so I fell asleep there. And when I came to in the morning, I just walked out and got in the car and drove home. I'm sure I was still drunk. And my husband, I got home and the three kids, you know, he said, I don't know what you're going to do, but you've got to do something. I said, I'm going to work. And I had those three kids. It was summer. I had a play date arranged for the youngest, and he was 4. So they were 4, 7. Actually, he was 3. They were 3, 7, and 10 at that time. And the other two played well with each other. So I just closed the door to my bedroom, and I just got down on my knees, and I just prayed. I can't do this. I never want to drink again. And that was my prayer. I never want to drink again. I wasn't particularly religious, like the whole spiritual group thing that went by the wayside when I started drinking. I have found that I can't really have a spiritual life, an active spiritual life, and drink at the same time. It just has not been compatible for me. So I got on my knees and I said that desperate prayer, and I felt a sense of real calm come over me, and that everything would be okay, but there would be work to do. So there's all kinds of spiritual experiences. I mean, they talk about that, the appendix in the big book, about the varieties of religious experiences and spiritual experiences. But for me, I had that. And I had the compulsion to drink was removed from me for a while. But I knew about AA. My best friends had been in AA a year before I got in. She'd gone to treatment. And another good friend, there were three of us, that our kids were all the same age, so we did a lot of things together. One went into treatment. The other woman, I didn't bring it. I actually, my original big book, but she gave it to me. I was looking at it last night, and she gave this to me actually December before I got sober. And it said, may the light shine your way home, or something like that. And I read the big book when I was drinking. I read it all the way through. I just thought it was fascinating. And I thought, if I ever know anybody who has a drinking problem, you know, there are people out there planting these seeds all over the place, you know. And I mean, I guess we do that too. And who knows when the person is actually ready. So I didn't drink for I didn't drink. I haven't had a drink since then. We left for vacation the next day, and we went down the Outer Banks with some family, and my sister-in-law's boyfriend. We always drank. I mean, we always drank together. And vacations, I always started drinking in the morning. And at the end of that 2 weeks, he was carting out cases of beer. Rather than, you know, we didn't run out of beer. And I just felt like I was in this protective bubble. I didn't want to drink. But I also knew I needed to go. Well, I don't know what I needed. I knew about AA. I knew from my friend. A few days before my last drunk, I had made an appointment with a counselor because I thought I was crazy. I was desperately unhappy, desperately lonely. I felt like I was just a shell of a human being. I felt like I wanted to kill myself again. You know, I'd been... Suicide it was always seemed to be an option. And so I had made this... When I started thinking of killing myself, I thought I need to talk to somebody. So I went to her office, and she suggested that I go to AA, and I told her I was an alcoholic. I didn't believe I was an alcoholic, but I told her that. And she got me a meeting list, and she said, do you want me to get somebody to go to a meeting with you? And I said, oh, no, that's fine, I'll go. And I went to my first meeting at St. Paul's. So this was after being 2 weeks without a drink, and I felt like this was the work I'd been told that, you know, there was work to do. And I went to the meeting at St. Paul's Church on Thursday night in Charlottesville, where Jenny goes there now, and picked up my white chip. And it was a pretty big meeting, and they would bring people in. There's a Mountain Wood treatment was still there, and they'd bring in a busload of people from Mountain Wood and still smoked in the meeting. So a nice big cloud of smoke in there. And I was just such a good smoker. I wasn't going to smoke in the meeting. I was just smoke outside the meeting. But I picked up my white chip there. So I was 30 days sober, and I was so happy I got my blue chip. And that was the chip I was the happiest to get. I never thought I could go a week without drinking, and to go 30 days without a drink. And I was so proud of it, and I was at work, and I showed it to my coworker, and I said, I haven't had a drink in 30 days. And he said, oh. And he reached in his pocket, and he said, then you probably want this. And it was some pot. And I thought, this is a gift from God. So I smoked up that pot. And it took me 5 years of feeling guilty to change my sobriety date to when I had my last drug. Because every year I'd pick up that medallion and I would think that I wasn't really clean and sober. So I changed my sobriety date in my fifth year. So I have a clear conscience. So, but I did have an epiphany with the pot, where I was sitting out there on the porch smoking and looking at the star, you know, all this day. And I go, this has nothing to do with sobriety. This has nothing to do with sobriety. So that was it. I've had a very slow, I think, recovery. I wasn't anybody who jumped into the steps right away. My first sponsor had never worked the steps. She was wonderful. We had a great relationship. We had a great fellowship. We talked a lot that first year, and, you know, she was there for me. And my second sponsor started working the steps, and I didn't do my fourth step. I was 2.5 years sober, and things really started to change then. My life got better, but, you know, things really started to change once I'd done my fourth and fifth step and progressed on And, you know, I've worked all the 12 steps now, and I really live in the maintenance steps now. I was at a VAC convention 2 years ago, I guess the 2008 one, up in Northern Virginia, and I heard a speaker there said that he reads every morning page 85 to the end of that chapter, you know, where it says that we have our sobriety is contingent on our spiritual condition, and we can't rest on our laurels. And, you know, I've been doing that just about every day since then. And, you know, it's right there. I mean, that's what the program is for me today, or in those pages. My marriage didn't get my marriage was on the rocks. It didn't get better right away. And it was also like, I heard what people said in the rooms about what my first year, my husband and I fought more about me going to meetings than we ever fought about me drinking. He didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I didn't believe I was an alcoholic, actually, but I knew I didn't want to drink. And, you know, it took 9 months of going to meetings till I got it, and I believed it, and it was in my bones that, yes, it's true, I am an alcoholic. I kept trying to compare out, but, you know, that's, I'm just like everybody else here, so. So 5 years in, we really got to work on our marriage, and, you know, it's good today. One of the things in my fourth and fifth step, that I needed to look at, that I looked at, was my relationship with the medical community. My big resentments towards the medical community and what that was based on. And it wasn't really based on a whole lot of anything other than my own fear of being a peer of authority and, you know, who I make the authority in my life, you know, or something. You know, just, and a lot to do with my personality rather than the medical community. So I got in a right relationship with the medical community. I worked at the post office for 5 years, and when I was 2.5 years sober, the position became really it was not a good place for me to be. I was working with people I formerly drank with. The man that I had the affair with was harassing me, and I felt trapped. I mean, I couldn't really, you know, and I just kept praying and trying to do the next right thing. And then they changed my job to really horrible hours, and I just came home from work, and I said, I want to quit. And my husband said, I think you should. And it was just a big, big blessing. And I quit. And I didn't work for a year. I did a lot of volunteer work at my kids' school. And then I started working as a teacher's aide at the school. I always thought I wanted to be a teacher. And I did that for 2 or 3 years. And then I knew I didn't want to be a teacher. So I'm glad I had that experience. Because, you know, I didn't put a lot of education into it. But I had it was very good for me. And, so then I wanted to be a musician, so I started, I am a musician, so I started playing out, and that was really fun. Actually, it was Easter of 1996, so it was the Saturday before the Easter of 1996. I had played this little gig at Greenberry's, and I had so much fun. I did a solo thing. I'd done something with a band or, you know, a couple of things, but I just did this solo thing. And there are a lot of AA people there, really supported me. And I was just seventh heaven. I never had the courage to do anything like that. I mean, I played guitar and I sang, but to actually go out and play in public, I just never had the courage to do it. The next morning, my middle son, came down, and, you know, the kids had found their Easter baskets and all this, and he was 14, was he? Yeah. And he said, Mom, I think I got a big problem. And I said, really? And he pulled up his pant leg, and he had this bump on his leg. And it's like, oh. Well, we probably should. He was leaving for a class trip to Florida, eighth grade class trip to Florida on Wednesday, that they had worked years for this trip, fundraising and stuff. They go a week to swim with the dolphins. It was like an ecological trip, and they had done so much work for this trip. And I said, well, let's go, rather than wait till Monday, we'll just go to the emergency room and have it checked out so that, you know, whatever they need to do, we can get it done and you can get on here. Well, that's when I learned that you can tell from one x-ray that your child has bone cancer. So, we lived with his cancer. For 19 months. And what I'm really grateful for is because when he was diagnosed that day, that Sunday, very much like today, sunny, Easter, my first thought was that now I could drink. Because everybody would understand that. So that's how I know I'm a real alcoholic. My second thought was, if I drink, I won't be there for him. And I really want to be there. So I didn't drink. I didn't think of drinking again during his whole treatment. It did not cross my mind. We had a really, if you can do such a thing well, I think we did it really well. And the support of the AA community and his school community, the Charlottesville community, supported us. And I stopped doing everything to take care of him. And he passed away in October of 97, when he was 16. He'd had his leg amputated. He'd had been through many chemotherapies, many radiations. He never wanted to quit fighting it. We went to Detroit during the last 2 weeks of his life for some palliative care, which really did help. But by that time, the tumors were too much in his lungs. I went to AA in Detroit. We were in inner city Detroit. That's where all the hospitals are. And Detroit is a third world country. I mean, here I'm living in rural Virginia. I don't lock my door half the time. I mean, I just forget about it. And we were locked down everything. Every AA meeting you go in, you had to sign in, you know, your whole name in. And it was always behind locked doors. The first AA meeting I went there was three blocks away. And the woman, we were staying in the Ronald McDonald House, and the woman in the Ronald McDonald House says, you take a cab. I was like, oh, okay. We went into a McDonald's, and there was bulletproof glass between the customers and the people that worked there. You know, they'd spin your meal around to you. I mean, it's a different country. But I'd go to the AA meetings, and I'd hear the same message, and I would share with my, you know, from my heart. And I feel like it was a prayer. The last meeting I went there, I said, I just want my son to. I don't want my son to die in Virginia. I mean, in Detroit. And I feel like it was the prayers of the people there that just got us home. We got home on a Saturday night, and he passed away the next Tuesday. So, grief in sobriety is doable. I would go to the meetings and just sit in the room. I didn't feel like talking to anybody too much. I didn't feel like I could connect with anybody, but I just knew I was conditioned to going to meetings, whatever. You guys in Charlottesville just carried me. people would pick me up and take me Christmas shopping. I mean, I had other children to deal with, and they just took me out Christmas shopping. We just did it. We just did it somehow. So, 5 years after that, so I had a very severe depression, and I had to recreate my higher power because I had taken too much to heart, kind of the things. I just felt like, you know, my higher power, of my understanding, did not take my son. Someone told me last week, you know, that the thing in Dr. Paul's story about acceptance is the answer and nothing happens by mistake. And he said that I choose to believe this, that someone said if he could change one sentence, and what he wrote in that story would be that sentence about nothing happens by mistake. Because I don't think that, I choose not to believe in a higher power that took my son for some other reason, you know. I don't think, my higher power doesn't micromanage like that. So, but I did go through a severe depression, and I wanted to drink. I wanted to drink every day. I wanted to kill myself, and I wanted to drink, which is the same thing. So, my sponsor at the time, I just stayed really, really close to her. And I just kept faking it. I just, you know, fake it till you make it. I faked my meditations every morning. I still got up and prayed and meditated, and I just faked it. I just faked it. And I kept wanting a sign from a higher power that there was a higher power, because I couldn't believe in a higher power. And that's the solution, you know. And if you're an alcoholic trying to recover and that you can't believe in a higher power, you're kind of pretty hosed. So, and that's what the steps are to have us have that spiritual experience and find that higher power. So, I started working the steps over again. And I started writing out my drinking history. Because I started thinking that maybe it wasn't that bad. Maybe I didn't really have a problem. You know, I didn't drink like some of you people. And then I started writing it out. And I didn't even get through like the first year and a half. And I had so many consequences. I'm like, I do have a problem here. So I didn't want to go the whole way. But that didn't help me with the higher power thing. And one morning I'm sitting there doing my meditation, and I'm thinking, wait a minute, what about how you stop drinking? What about the night, like, when you could not stop drinking? And the morning when you got on your knees and you said, I never want to drink again. And I said, that was a miracle. That I didn't do that. There's no way I did that. That I couldn't stop drinking. And I said, I had this miracle the whole time. I had the evidence the whole time. I just forgot. And, you know, and then I got connected back. So, I love being sober. I love AA. It's just, you know, life is up and down. And, you know, sometimes now I even, you know, this last couple of weeks has been difficult. I mean, I'm glad you asked. I don't think it's a coincidence. You know, it's a God incident. I'm telling my story today. It's been a difficult 2 weeks for me. I have times of the year that just physically I just start going into grief, and sometimes it takes me a while to acknowledge that. That's what I love about meetings too, because I'll sit in the chair and I'll discover what I'm feeling. Or I'll hear something from somebody. You know, for me, my higher power speaks through your voices, and I'll hear something I need to hear. And meetings have always been important to me. Oh, I do want to say, sort of backtracking, is because of that first fourth step that I did, and I got in right relationship with the medical community, when my son was being treated, we were a team. And we were not fighting each other. And we were working together as a team. And that's what you really need. And ironically or whatever, I am making a living amends to the medical community. I've worked for physicians. I've been working for physicians for 9 years now, or 10. Different ones, but I'm in a really good practice now, and I love the physicians, and they're really good people who are really trying to help people. And I see people like myself every day. I deal with drug seekers every day. We have non-compliant patients that the doctors really spend a lot of time with trying to somehow address what they need to do. And we have people like myself who refuse treatment. So, you know, I am there all the time. And I just feel like it's about being of service. And I thought in the fall that I needed to quit this job. I was getting really resentful about this job. I didn't want to be with the health system anymore. I went back and did a really thorough four-step. It was thorough. When I went to do my fifth step with my sponsor, we started like at 6 o'clock and it didn't leave till like 9:30. So it was a lot of stuff that had gotten all gummed up again. And everything I've been complaining, all my issues with my job changed after I did that. I mean, they weren't doing the schedule right, they weren't doing this right, you know, they were getting preferential treatment and they weren't paying attention to me and all this stuff. And the message I got out of that step was to let it go. Just let it go completely. And since then, I've got this really cool schedule. They're treating me with respect. I don't know. This program, it's blowing my mind. And actually, two of my coworkers were intervened in December. And one of them chose not to follow the protocols that they want her to follow and quit. And the other is in early recovery. And I'm watching her mind be blown. I'm just trying to keep a little bit of hands off. I said, you know, I can't sponsor you. I'd love to be your friend and you know, encourage you. But I just don't feel like I can sponsor you and work with you. But It's really and when I was in early recovery, I had people that were in recovery in my workplace, and it was just somehow it was just so grounding. I could look across the room and see Bill working over there. Yeah, okay, I can get through tonight because Bill's here and he's sober. So, it's time to stop. I'm trying to think if there's any last words I want to say. I just really, those pages 85 through 89 are just my guide, and I need them every day. Maybe I'm sicker than most, but I just need to be reminded what I'm doing every day. I forget quickly that I have a fatal disease that has a spiritual solution. And when I read those pages and I do my prayer and meditation, which I don't do every day, I mean, I'm not a saint. I generally have good days and I can deal with whatever's presented. When I get off the beam, things get a little more difficult. So, and I think that's all I'm going to say tonight. Thanks for listening.